أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل. اللهم اخرجنا من ظلمات الوهم وإكرمنا بنور الفهم. اللهم افتح علينا أبواب رحمتك وانشر علينا من خزائن علومك يا أرحم الراحمين. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا وانفعنا بما علمتنا وزدنا علما. My brothers and my sisters, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. After the events of Saqifa and throughout the times to come, we find the tactic of the alienation of the Banu Hashim. In order to strip away their moral and material weapons against the ruling party, so they were alienated. We see this in several different ways. The first way, it was through threats. They were prepared to use force. We saw how prepared they were to use force against Sa'd ibn Ubadah in the Saqifa meeting when he was beaten. And we see what happened on that fateful night outside the house of Sayyidah Fatima alayhi salam, when her house was threatened with being burnt down and it was barged into. So force was a tactic they would use if necessary. We see in the times to come afterwards, the Banu Hashim would always be sidelined. In the ruling government, there was no position for anyone from Banu Hashim. Even though the Banu Umayyah had many positions, no one from the Banu Hashim did. Even later on, you see in the reign of Umar, when Ibn Abbas was going to be the ruler of Homs, he was sidelined because there was a fear that he would give the Banu Hashim a face of an uprising. The threat of the uprising remained even for decades later. We see even when it came to Khalid ibn Sa'id ibn al-As, who was someone who, after the Saqifa had happened, he came out and he questioned, why are we giving bay'ah to Abu Bakr when we gave the bay'ah to Ali already? He sided with the Banu Hashim and Imam Ali alayhi salam after the Saqifa. Because of that, he remained in the minds of the ruling party. That's why later on, when he was going to be a leader in an army to go and conquer Sham, he was disposed of by Abu Bakr. Umar reminded him, remember, this is someone who at the time of the Khilafah dispute, he sided with Ali. So he was someone they couldn't trust. You see, there were several different forms of these tactics. Even when Umar ibn al-Khattab was to pass away and he wanted to leave the issue of the Khilafah in a shura, in a council, he selected six people from that council. He selected those six people and he said, whoever is voted into being the leader of these six people will become the Khalifa. In these six people was Ali ibn Abi Talib, along with people like Zubair, people like Uthman, people like Talha, who at the time Zubair was thinking of the Saqifa that Ali is the rightful leader. Now he's in a council, he can be leader. Notice how they were normalizing this concept of Imam Ali alayhi salam being the rightful leader. It was normalized that this was not the case. They were trying to get rid of that concept. So there is no more moral right against them, against the ruling party. And this remained for decades. Now, we come back to the chronological story. Now, it is Monday. The Prophet had passed away in the morning. Saqifa happened in the morning. The dispute between the Quraysh, the Muhajirin, and the Ansar occurs. Abu Bakr takes the bay'ah. The Banu Aslam, they begin to fill the streets. Slowly, everyone starts to give Abu Bakr the bay'ah. They walk through the streets. Umar is speaking. He brings the people, give him the bay'ah. We have a new Khalifa. It's done. Abu Bakr starts taking the bay'ah. Then he goes now. It's the night time. It's Monday night. Abu Bakr goes into the masjid. And he starts to take the bay'ah from the people. He sits on the manbar of Rasulullah. And the people start coming in. And everything's happening very quickly. And people are giving the bay'ah. Next door is Imam Ali alayhi salam in his house. He hears what's happening. He remains in his house. He was not at the Saqifa. He was at the burial of the Prophet. He buried the Prophet. Everyone who was at Saqifa was not at the burial of the Prophet. And everyone at the burial was not at Saqifa. So here, Imam Ali alayhi salam is grieving. He is still in mourning. It's Monday night. He is still grieving for the loss of the Prophet Meanwhile, the people are giving bay'ah to Abu Bakr in the masjid. The night passes, and now it is Tuesday morning. Now Imam Ali is inside Masjid al-Nabawi. He's sitting with Zubair, with Miqdad, with Ammar, and they're speaking about what's going on. Over there, there's also another group. The Bani Umayyah are sitting down. Uthman and his clan are speaking. Several different groups are sitting in the masjid, and Abu Bakr and Umar walk in. And so Umar ibn al-Khattab looks around and says, "What are you all doing still sitting down? Stand up and give bay'ah to the Khalifa." People were looking around. He already had garnered so much support from the Quraysh and from the allianced tribes. The Bani Umayyah stood up and went to him and began to give him the bay'ah. Here, Ali stood up and walked away. Walked to his house. No response. Now here's something that I want to mention. Remember, one of the honors given to Ali ibn Abi Talib is the fact that his house was the only house that had a door connected to the masjid. The Prophet Muhammad had ordered during his lifetime to close all the doors except the door of Ali. And people were a bit upset by this, but the Prophet said, "This is not my order, the order is from the heavens." The door of Imam Ali alayhi salam was connected to the masjid. That was Bab Ali. So Ali goes home through his Bab. He goes, opens the door and goes home. Umar gives a speech to the people about the new Khalifa, the new movement, the new uprising now of the Muslim Ummah, that it's not going to be a weak Ummah. This Ummah is a strong Ummah. He's giving them motivation, inspiration. He gives a speech, a khutbah, and then he turns to Abu Bakr and he tells Abu Bakr, "Call for Ali. As long as Ali isn't giving the bay'ah, this will not be seen as legitimate. They need the stamp of Ali ibn Abi Talib." And he could not hold out for too long. It's already been 24 hours. If he holds out for any longer, then people might start to take their bay'ah back, go back on their word. They realize Ali might revolt. They did not want Ali to revolt. They gave him a whole day. He still did not give the bay'ah. Umar said, "It's time, Abu Bakr, you have to call him. If you don't, we will not get over this fitna." So Abu Bakr tells him, "Go and get the bay'ah from him." He sends Umar. Umar gathers his friends, companions, warriors, Khalid ibn Walid, they all come with him. And he goes to the house. He goes outside and he stands outside the house. Now it's towards the night time. It's been a day and a half. And Imam Ali alayhi salam has still not come out and given the bay'ah. Now, here's what I want you to imagine. Take yourself there and notice these points. This is the house of Ali. This is the masjid. Abu Bakr is here in the masjid, on the minbar. He can hear what's happening. The house of Ali is here. The house of Ali has a door connected to the masjid, as I mentioned. That's Bab Ali. When the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would go to visit his daughter and his grandsons, he would go and knock on narrations, on reports. It says Bab Fatima. He would go around outside and knock on the door. أدخل. He would seek permission to come in. She said, "Albayt baytuk, this is your house. Albayt baytuk, this is your house. My father, Ya Rasulullah." He would come in through the door of Fatima, Bab Fatima. That door was Bab Ali. Siddul Abwab illa Baba. Close the doors except his door, the door of Ali. So it had two doors. There was the back door connected to the masjid, and the front door connected to the outside, which is the door Rasulullah used to come from. He never used to come from the back door. That one was Imam Ali would go to pray Salat and come back. So here, Imam Ali is in the house. Umar and the warriors and his companions are outside the house. Inside the house with Imam Ali alayhi salam are his trusted companions, Ammar, Salman, Zubair, Miqdad. They were inside the house. Now we know that when there's a group of men, in the Islamic tradition, they do not mix with a group of women or a woman. Imam Ali alayhi salam is sitting down on the other side of the house next to his door with his companions. Sayyidah Zahra is not sitting with them. She's on her side of the house. Even if it was a small house, they are split. However much you want to say they were split, you want to say as small as the house is, they're not all sitting together. Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam is next to her door. They are next to Ali's door. Umar calls out, "Come out of the house and give bay'ah." No response. come out of the house and give bay'ah. And if you don't, we will burn your house down. That was a threat. And this threat is found in Sunni narrations, as well as Shi'i narrations, of course. The Shi'i narrations speak in more detail about what was happened afterwards. In the Sunni narrations, it even explains that someone called out, when he threatened to burn the house, someone called out, Ya Umar, the daughter of Rasulullah is inside the house. And here, Umar ibn al-Khattab responded, Wa in, and if she is. Now, here is when it cuts off in the Sunni narrations. In the Shia narrations, it explains what happens inside. Sayyidah Fatima alayhi salam calls out. She says, Ya Umar, you want to threaten to burn our house down? How can you be doing this? When you left us with the Prophet, when he was still unburied, and you took our right, may Allah be the judge between us. Umar called out, if you don't come out and give the bay'ah, we'll burn the house. Imam Ali did not come out. So Umar ibn al-Khattab saw that he had no choice. And he rampaged to the door. And he broke the door down with Sayyidah Fatima alayhi salam on the other side. The door opened violently. With her behind it, it slammed onto her. And she was squeezed behind the door. Her ribs were wounded and she fell to the ground. At this moment, and imagine, this is happening in mere seconds. Umar comes in, his warriors behind him. Ali stands, he sees his wife just drop to the ground. He runs to Umar and grabs him. The people walk in, the companions of Imam Ali come. Zubayr takes his sword out, but they smash the sword of Zubayr out of his hand. Imam Ali alayhi salam at that moment looks around, he sees the swords are out. His companions are threatened with death. His wife is on the ground and Ali stands and he is surrounded and he has a choice to make. Fight and die. And if anyone wants to say Ali would have taken them all out, please look at reality. Ali ibn Abi Talib is not going to kill 1,000 people. In Badr he killed 35 and that was one of the greatest performances in his life, if not the greatest. He looked around. If only I had 40 men, he said. That's what he said beforehand and afterwards, 40 men, but he had none. Only 5 came to assist him. The Imam looked around and he had no choice. He held his ground. He could not sacrifice his and everyone else's life at that moment when Islam was still a child that he had to nurture. It's not for Ali scared for his own life. It's Ali's love for Islam. God forbid, even if he took his sword out, Fatima would have said, Ya Ali, what are you doing? My father told you, if you have no support, how can you fight them? The aim of this night, the priority was for Ali to get through this night alive because they wanted to kill him. And I will bring the proof of why. Because they dragged him outside of the house. As they dragged Ali outside of the house, Sayyidah Fatima stood up, even though she was wounded. She tried to stand up to say, leave my cousin. But Imam Ali told Salman not to let Fatima come. So Salman went and told Fatima, your husband has told you not to come, stay here. So she said, I trust him. I will obey. I'll stay. And she sat in the house to heal her wound by herself. And her children were there. They dragged Imam Ali alayhi salam to the masjid where Abu Bakr was waiting. They brought him forward to Abu Bakr and Imam Ali alayhi salam stood and saw and watched on. Abbas, Imam Ali's uncle, heard about what was happening and rushed to the masjid and told him, don't kill my nephew, because the swords were out. Umar's sword, they had threatened him now. The swords were out. And they told him, Ya Abul Hassan, give bay'ah. And his hand stayed clenched. He kept a fist. He would not give it. And so Umar told him, give the bay'ah. If you don't give the bay'ah, you will be killed. Here, the Imam said, what if I don't give the bay'ah? They said, you will be killed. And he said, you will kill the servant of Allah and the brother of Rasulullah. They said, you're the servant of Allah, but you're not the brother of Rasulullah. They already denied him the brotherhood that he had, that everyone knew about. They denied him this. He looked around and he said, I am more worthy of this than you. You have taken our right. You came forward and you told the Ansar
that you are closer to the Prophet. You put that argument forward. So now I'm putting the same argument forward to you. Am I not the closest to Rasulullah? They ignored him. Umar once again said, give the bay'ah. So Ali looked at Umar and told him, milk the udder, O Umar, until it gives you what you want tomorrow. Squeeze onto it today, so it gives you what you want tomorrow. When he said this, Abu Ubaidah said, Ya Ali, we're not here to argue about your position with Rasulullah, but you're young. Abu Bakr is our elder. Ali looked at him and then looked back at Abu Bakr and said, you took our right. And Abu Bakr said, yes, but I did it because of fitna, sedition. I didn't want there to be corruption and fitna. At that moment, they grabbed his hand and they took it, his fist, and they put it onto the hand of Abu Bakr. And they began to shout, Bay'a Abul Hasan. Abul Hasan has given bay'a. Imam Ali has given bay'a, they began to say. Imam Ali looked around. What could he do? Was he going to fight a losing battle? The Quraysh were ready with their swords out. One little mistake they were waiting for one of their aggressive loons to make a move with a sword. One mistake. Ali had to be so careful not to allow them to have an excuse where they could say he's now moving against the law, he is a rebel, he's revolting. He could not have that. 560 years the Quraysh ruled the Empire of Islam. 560 years from this day. You think they were willing to compromise? On 560 years, there was no compromise. Everyone was on edge. Everyone was ready for battle. Everyone had their sword drawn. The companions were then forced to give the bay'ah. Salman looked at them and said, you did and you did not. As in, you chose a khalifa, but you did not follow the order of Rasulullah. Now, people want to speak about the claim that Imam Ali alayhi salam gave his oath of allegiance to Abu Bakr voluntarily. And sometimes they try to bring you different sources from different books to prove so. Whereas you have to look at the context of everything, and you have to look in history. We find, as I mentioned in the History of Prophet Muhammad series, there are always conflicting narrations throughout the lives of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. And you have to bring those narrations forward and you have to weigh them out based on evidence. And I mentioned this in the previous series for anyone who is willing to watch. Here we also want to look at the context in which these ahadith were expressing what occurred on this day. We have Shi'i ahadith and Sunni ahadith. So we see in these Shi'i sources, Al-Khisal by Shaykh Al-Saduq, where he speaks about companions, 12 of them, of the Muhajirin and Ansar, come to the house of Ali afterwards. And they tell him, Ya Ali, how could you let your right go? Aren't you going to resist? Aren't you going to fight back? They wanted to fight these 12 men. And Ali tells them, let me explain to you. It's not that I want to give up my right. I was forced, and you are an insignificant number. If you go to resist right now, you will be killed. He told them. And this faith is only 20 years old. He has to nourish it and nurture it. After the Prophet has just left it and left it in his hands, in his amana. What's he going to do? He's telling them, you're going to be killed. We see in Al-Ihtijaj, a book that some people use against us and say that, look, in this book, a Shi'i source, we see that the author says, Ali gave the bay'ah. Under what context? On the context that I just explained. In the same book, the context is that he is shackled, he is threatened, he is dragged outside the house, sword on the neck, and then he is told to give the bay'ah. Habibi, what bay'ah is he giving? What legitimacy do you take from that? People want to say, Ali is not one to be forced. Ali is not being forced here to save his own life, he does it. Since when does Ali do things for his own self? When does he act on his own behalf? He's doing this for Islam. It's not about being forced or not, being stubborn or not. We see it even in Sunni narrations, they speak about what occurred. Not to the same extent, but they speak about what occurred. In Al-Aqd al-Farid and in Ansab al-Ashraf, they speak about the coercion. They speak about the force that was applied onto Imam Ali alayhi salam. Al-Baladuri even says that he felt sorry for the Imam, for what was happening to him. In the book, in Aqd al-Farid, it is said that Abu Bakr sends Umar, and he said that if he fights, if Ali and Zubayr fight against you, then if they resist, fight them. Fight back against them. So this rhetoric was available in different sources. And here, my brothers and sisters, it's not about bravery, it's not about courage. Courage is courage in the right place. Again, Imam Ali alayhi salam says it perfectly, and I say it again and again. Justice is to put each thing in its rightful place. Courage is courage in its rightful place. But when courage is done in a place, when courage is exacted at a time that it's not needed, it becomes recklessness. Recklessness, not courage. And the Imam was never reckless. The Ahlul Bayt were brave, but not reckless. Was Imam Ali alayhi salam the brave, courageous warrior? Was he reckless in Mecca in the early years of Islam? When the Prophet was told by Jibra'il that he would be assassinated in the night time, and that's why he had to go on Hijrah, and he told Imam Ali, sleep in my bed. When he told him that they were coming to kill me, did the Imam say, where are they, Rasulullah? Show me where they are. Let me go and fight them. No, because you're in Mecca, and you're a few Muslims, and there are thousands from Quraysh. You will be killed. They're not reckless. The Imam slept in the Prophet's bed that night, that if he was to die, he was to die. But now there is no Prophet. Now the Prophet has passed. Ali is the one now to lead Islam. Before, if Ali was going to leave this world, the Prophet was there. Islam was in safe hands. Now Rasulullah is gone. In the second day, you want Ali to leave as well? Who is left of the essence of Islam? What is left after Rasul and Ali? So, the Imam doesn't fight, and for good reason. And anyone who thinks otherwise and says Ali would never accept this to happen to, for example, his wife, might happen in a few seconds. If someone's wife is there and something happens to her, does that mean that he is weak? He wasn't there a few meters away. He ran, he grabbed Umar, the people stood around him, and this threat was imposed upon him. Whichever way you look at it, the Imam was threatened, even with death, and he says this. And he says a very impactful verse from the Quran at this moment, when he's in the masjid. And it's the verse that Nabi Harun uses. Nabi Harun, he uses this verse when Nabi Musa, alayhi salam, Moses, leaves his people. Harun is now the one, a prophet of God, who stays behind and is supposed to guide the people. Here, the people slowly began to go and worship the calf. They went into shirk, only 40 days. And Moses left 40 days. And Moses brought them miracle after miracle. He split the sea. He turned a stick into a snake. What miracle is greater than this in terms of the way that you see it with your eyes, your physical eyes? It's right in front of you. How could the people doubt Moses? Yet 40 days and they strayed from his path. Why is it so difficult for you to believe that people strayed from the path of Rasulullah right afterwards? This is what I don't understand about some very intelligent people, that they say that I cannot believe in the narrative of events that the Shia speak about because it's just so unlikely. How is this unlikely? It happened in the Quran. 40 days and they left his path and they're worshipping the calf. And here, Nabi Musa returns. And when he sees this, he says, Ya Harun, what happened to my ummah? And Harun says, my brother, إِنَّ الْقَوْمَ اسْتَضْعَفُونَنِي وَكَادُوا يَقْتُلُونَنِي. My brother, the people, they took me, they forced me, and they were going to kill me. Imam Ali alayhi salam says those same words as Harun. He said, my brother, I thought that if they were going to kill me, you would return, you'd find me dead, and your ummah has dispersed and they've left each other. This was all I could do to keep them together. Subhanallah, the Imam narrates the same verse. Again, for good reason. And we find in Islamic law how coercion invalidates any transaction. You cannot do something in a forced manner. A divorce, if it is forced, is not legitimized. A marriage, if it is forced, is not legitimized. So how can a bay'ah, when it is forced, be legitimized? Not only that, but even if the imam was refused the bay'ah, it's not Imam Ali's right to give imamah away. or to give Khilafah away. The same way the prophethood cannot create another prophet. He always said to Ali, Ya Ali, you are to me as Harun is to Musa. But there is no prophet after me. If the prophet cannot make another person a prophet, how can Imam Ali make another person an imam or validate that for them? He cannot. It's not even in his right to do that. In fact, Imam Ali alayhi salam's refusal to give homage was so well known that Muawiyah himself was writing about it to him in a letter. And the Imam responds, and you can find his response in Nahjul Balagha, where he tells Muawiyah, you want to bring up the time when I was dragged from my house like a camel, with a rope around my neck, and every humiliation and cruelty was leveled against me? He mentions it. Therefore, the people had now regarded that Imam Ali alayhi salam had given the bay'ah to Abu Bakr, even though it was forced. This sad night came to an end. The Imam was left alone. He came out of the masjid and he went back home. And you can imagine the scenes. How would it have felt as he came back into the home to see Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam sitting, tending to her wounds with Al-Hasan, with Al-Husayn by her side. The Imam, you can only imagine him sitting down with them as her tears strolled and their tears strolled down their cheeks. It's only normal for the Imam to have a heart full of pain, a heavy, heavy heart on this night. They had just lost the Prophet the day before. This is the madlumiyya of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Afterwards, the 12 companions come and knock on the door of Imam Ali, as I mentioned. They told him, Ya Ali, are you not going to resist? He tells them, my brothers, there is nothing that you can do. If you go to fight him, if you go to fight them, you will all be killed. They still harbor envy and hatred towards me from days gone by, the people around in Quraysh. If you're going to do something, do it without force. If you want to advise him, but use no force. So they went to the masjid and they said, Ya Abu Bakr, are you going to continue on this path that you have taken? You've taken the right of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Here, Umar quietened them down, gave another khutbah, and he warned, if anyone wants to do this again, then they were going to have to face a severe punishment. People could not speak up anymore. This was now law. So Imam Ali had no choice now. He could not fight with the sword. He didn't have enough supporters. He couldn't stand up against them. He had forced the bay'ah. The only choice the Imam had left was to protect Islam in whatever way he could. So he went towards damage limitation. Here, he tries to protect Islam through warning, through advice, through helping in whatever way that he could, whilst not giving legitimacy in terms of his bay'ah, of course. So you see how, with all sincerity, throughout the reigns of Abu Bakr and Umar, when times were tough, even though Imam Ali alayhi salam became very reserved, when times were tough, he would be the person to go to. Imam Ali alayhi salam feared so much for Islam. He loved Islam the way the Prophet loved Islam. He could see that the different Jewish tribes at the time, Bani Nadir and Bani Qurayda, they were there on the outskirts watching what's happening. If right now the Muslims were to get into a civil war 20 years after Islam basically began, and a day after the Prophet passes away, the Muslims would be easy pickings. You had the Christians, the tribes of Najran, you had the Byzantine Empire, they were all watching on. They could easily take advantage of the situation. The Imam did not want Islam to be at risk. So he put his own self aside, as difficult as that pill is to swallow. And I don't know how a human being like him is able to live with swallowing such a pill, such a difficult pill. And he does, for Islam and for Allah. So much so that even during the reign of Umar, during one of the wars and the conquests, Umar was going to the battle and Imam Ali told him, don't go. If you go, there's a risk in this battle, you will be killed. And the leader of the Muslims cannot be killed. So here, he sincerely gave him advice to save his life. So much so that Umar himself says, Were it not for Ali ibn Abi Talib, Umar would have perished. Of course, we see in the years to go by, in the two decades to follow, this is what occurred. Imam Ali, alayhi salam, he could not speak to them about the ahadith that everyone knew. The testimonies. He could not come with a testimony. If they were prepared to call Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi himself delirious on his deathbed, then they were ready to deny any narration that Imam Ali came up with. If the Imam came and said, what about Hadith al-Dar? When the Prophet said, I was the Khalifa after him when I was 16 years old. What about the brotherhood? They already denied him the brotherhood when they said that you are not his brother. All of these different ahadith that we know about Imam Ali alayhi salam could have been denied if the Imam started bringing them up, because here now the people were conspiring against him, and he could see that. If the people in Medina that were conspiring against him all got together and bore witness against these ahadith, then the Imam now is making them become weak in front of people outside of Medina. You see, the Ansar themselves, he could not appeal to the Ansar, because the Ansar had already given bay'ah on that day. If he told the Ansar, Ya Ansar, I'm your Imam. Remember, you gave bay'ah to me in Ghadir. Here, the Ansar would be contradicting themselves on the same exact day. So they couldn't retract it. And the Imam could not allow these ahadith to lose their value outside of Medina. He had to preserve them. Because if they were denied right now by the Muhajirin and Ansar, if they were to be denied, how could the Ansar say, yes, you're right, and still give bay'ah to Abu Bakr? If they were to deny them there, the people outside Medina, the Muslims outside of Medina, would lose value to these if they were denied, if they were focused on and then made to look like they were not true. So the Imam did not want the ruling party to give attention to these ahadith right now in order to ruin it for the Muslims to come. Be sure, had the Imam used these ahadith at that time, they may not have come to us, because they were able to reach the Khilafah without them. There was no qabiliyah, we say. There was not going to be any effect if the Imam used these ahadith, except the downfall of these traditions. The traditions would have disappeared, or at least made to look like they were fabricated. Who focused on this idea? Muawiyah. Muawiyah focused on this idea. He realized this. That's why you find so many fabricated ahadith in the time of Muawiyah. But he couldn't fabricate all of them, and he couldn't erase them. He didn't have the power that Abu Bakr and Umar have at the end of the day. They were original Muhajirin. They had great power and popularity. They could have done away with that. So the Imam did not want to. He did not want to fight such a battle. And if he did have people from the Ansar and his companions who bore witness to his truth of these ahadith, then they will be singled out as people who are rebelling and revolting. And this would have led to a conflict and led to bloodshed, which is exactly what the Imam was trying to avoid. So there was no way that he could go. Which way does he go? And this is why, after the Saqifa happened and one of the companions said, how come we are giving bay'ah to Abu Bakr? Didn't we give it to Ali already? And then the response came from the Quraysh. They said, no, the prophethood and the imamah cannot join in one household. And the Imam heard this and said, who came up with this hadith? They said, the Prophet. And he said, do you have proof of this? And they all gathered and said, yes, we believe this happened. And they were lying. So the Imam stood and realized how far they were going to go. That's why in the Shura of Umar, the Council of Umar, Imam Ali says that, I knew they were not going to choose me. I knew it was set up in such a way that it was going to be Uthman who was going to be the Khalifa. And Ibn Abbas asked him afterwards, then why did you join the Shura if you knew that there was no point to it? If you knew that it was going to be Uthman anyway, why did you do that? He said, I did this to prove that Umar contradicted himself. Because if Imamah and Prophethood that they said cannot join together 20 years ago, they said they cannot join together under one household, how come I'm in the council? Why am I part of the council? So then they can join? Otherwise, you've put me here for no reason. So he wanted to show the contradiction and hypocrisy there. At the end of the day, we saw how far they were willing to go when they called the Prophet delirious. The Imam saw how far they're willing to go. He saw how far they're willing to go when they use force and violence. He did not want the traditions of Islam, of his position, and his position with Rasulullah and in Islam as the Imam, to be done away with and seem like it's fabricated for the people outside of Medina at the time and for us afterwards who are going to inherit this knowledge. So he stayed silent and did not use his ihtijaj. He postponed it until a later time when he was able to speak about these things, especially when he was the Khalifa. And this led to a culture of burning a hadith, doing away with a hadith, and even in some narrations in the Sunni sources, the idea that we should not take a hadith. And so I wanted to read some of these hadith to you now. Here, during the time of the Prophet, we have Abdullah, the son of Amr ibn al-As. He says, I used to write whatever I heard from the Messenger of Allah until the Quraysh prohibited me and said to me, do you write anything you hear from the Prophet whilst he's also a human who has rage and pleasure? So I stopped, he said. I stopped writing hadith until I informed the Prophet about what the Quraysh had said to me. Here the Prophet was alive. So the Prophet pointed to his mouth with his finger and he said, write. By the one my life in his mighty hand, none other than truth has come out of this mouth. Write. That's a hadith in the time of the Prophet. Another hadith during the reign of Abu Bakr. Here Al-Dhahabi narrates, after the demise of the Prophet, Abu Bakr called people and said, you have been narrating many a hadith from the Prophet, yet you dispute among yourselves about them. People who come after you will dispute even more about them. So, from now, do not narrate any more a hadith from the Prophet. Whoever asked you anything, tell them, between us and you is the Book of Allah. And accept halal is halal and haram is haram. Al-Dhahabi also narrates from Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr. She says, my father compiled 500 ahadith from the Prophet. One night during his khilafah, he was uneasy and he didn't sleep the whole night. In the morning he called me and he said, my daughter, bring me those ahadith that I have with you. So I brought them to him and he burnt them all. He then said, I worry that I die and there has been any hadith that I have narrated from the Prophet through a person that I assume to be honest and trustworthy where he was not. I do not wish to carry responsibility of a wrong narration on my neck. So he burnt that hadith. Whatever the reason was, he burnt it. We see during the reign of Umar, another one. Ibn Sa'd narrates from Urwa that Umar decided to write down the hadith of the Prophet. He sought the opinion of the companions about the matter, to which they positively consented. Nonetheless, Umar thought about it for a month and then announced, I had in mind to write down the hadith of the Prophet. Yet I remembered nations before you, those who wrote their books and abandoned the Book of Allah. By Allah, I will never mix the Book of Allah with anything else. Ibn Sa'd continues in this hadith, he says, Umar took an oath from people to bring all the books of hadith they had compiled, and when they all brought the books together, he burnt them and set them all on fire. During the reign of Uthman, we see the companion Abu Dharr refused to accept a total ban on narrating the hadith. And in response, he said, by Allah, if they threaten me by a sword to stop narrating the hadith of Rasulullah, I would rather die than stop narrating his hadith. And it is the belief that this is why he was exiled and why he died on his own. During the reign of Muawiyah, Muawiyah wrote an official letter with the content to all his delegates announcing that whoever narrates anything about the virtue of Ali ibn Abi Talib or his family is not under the protection of the government. It's another ban on hadith. Here we have so many ideas about the banning of hadith themselves that we find fabricated and ironic hadith, because they are hadith themselves and they're talking about banning hadiths. So here we find them and they are definitely fabricated. Here Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal here narrates that the Prophet said, do not quote me in other than the Quran. So whoever has written anything from me other than the Qur'an, erase it. Number two, Ahmad ibn Hanbal also narrates, the Messenger of Allah prohibited us from writing anything from him, and he erased them. Narration number three, and finally, Ahmad ibn Hanbal narrates from Abu Hurairah here, he says, we were sitting writing what we heard from the Prophet. When the Prophet arrived, he asked what we were writing. We said, what we have heard from you, Ya Rasulullah. So he said, are you compiling a book besides the book of Allah? We said, we're writing what we hear from you. So he said, the Prophet now says, write the book of Allah, write only the book of Allah. Are you writing other than the book of Allah? Write only the book of Allah. So Abu Huraira said, we followed the instruction of the Prophet and we collected our writings and burnt them in a fire. Which is quite remarkable itself, because no one has narrated more from the Prophet than Abu Huraira himself. But that's another story for another day. So you see, this idea of the narrations being done away with was very prevalent, and Imam Ali alayhi salam could not risk the plethora of ahadith, this great treasure that we had about him and his position in Islam. And so he did not bring up the ahadith and bring up his position with the Prophet anymore. We now come to the issue of Fadak. The ruling party feared that Fadak would be used to lure people away from their cause, because Fadak came with great wealth, especially when it came to the Bani Umayyah. Now, what is Fadak? You hear that name a lot. What is it? Fadak is a land that belonged to Sayyidah Fatima alayhi salam. It was given to her as a gift by Rasulullah. It was personally one of Rasulullah's belongings. It belonged to him. It was given to him as a gift by the people of Khaybar. It was not attained through war. That land which is attained through war belongs to all the Muslims. But that land which is given as a gift to the Prophet is his. This was a gift to the Prophet. And Jibreel told Rasulullah, give it to Fatima. And so Rasulullah gave this land to Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam. This belonged to her. And this was a vast land. A great village. She had workers there. It had great produce. The Prophet used to make a lot of wealth from this land. And he would spread it amongst the Muslims if he wanted to with his money. He gave the land to Fatima alayhi salam, became hers. It was confiscated from her. Abu Bakr took it from her. Now, at the time, he needed the money for the Muslims. He needed enough money because he gave so much of the money that was in Baytul Mal to Abu Sufyan and the Banu Umayyah to bring them on side. He didn't have enough left. He started spreading money around to different Muslims to give them gifts in order to... Right now, he's sweetening everyone up in the beginning of his rule. And this is proven by a narration which states that a woman, when she's given the gift, she says, are you trying to bribe me with my deen? You're trying to take my deen away from me by giving me money? I won't accept it. And she refused the gift. This is just a lay person that refused it. At one point, Abu Bakr was going to return it to Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam, but Umar told him, wait, how are you going to spend on the Muslims? With what money? We need Fadak. And this shows just how much wealth that Fadak had, that it could spend, it could be used to spend so much on thousands of Muslims. Now Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam, when this all happened, she wrote to Abu Bakr and sent a messenger telling him to give me my land. If you are the Khalifa, give me my land, and give me the khums, and give me what is rightfully mine. And he responded that prophets do not leave inheritance. And she said, no, I inherited this from my father. He gave me this as a gift. And he said, no, the prophets do not leave inheritance. This is what I heard the prophet say. And so one of them was lying. One of them said, no, it's inheritance. The other said, no, the prophet doesn't leave inheritance. Sayyidah Fatima alayhi salam asked for it back and he wouldn't give it back. And she became angry with him. This is interesting because we need to ask, how come the widows of the Prophet were able to keep their houses? Did they inherit those houses? How come they were all given very special gifts, especially Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr? How come before Abu Bakr passed away, he asked Aisha for permission to be buried in her house? If he asks her permission, that means he regards it as her house. So I have to ask, who gave Aisha that house? Did she inherit it from her deceased husband, Rasulullah? If she did, is that not inheritance from the Prophet? Fatima alayhi salam became angry with him. Now Aisha herself narrates that she was angry with my father and she never spoke to him again. This is in Sahih Bukhari that Aisha was angry with Abu Bakr, and later on in other ahadith, it said she died angry with him. Right now, Imam Ali alayhi salam had no more weapons. He had no sword that he could use for conflict, because this was not a choice, for the betterment of Islam. And he could not even use the narrations and traditions said so often by Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He had one weapon left, Fatima alayhi salam. The revolution now was in Fatima's hands. And this was because, firstly, she would evoke the emotions of the Muslims because she was the remaining person, that symbol of her father, the remnant of Rasulullah. She evoked the emotions of the people. That was the first advantage. The second advantage was, no matter what Sayyidina Fatima alayhi salam says now, when she goes, there's not going to be a battle with swords and bloodshed. She now spoke on behalf of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Sayyidina Zahra alayhi salam, she became the one to hold his cause. And she used Fadak as the way to do this. Of course, Sayyidina Zahra would not care about a land, however extravagant it was. And the proof of this is, easily in a court of law, an Islamic court of law, one of her witnesses was Imam Ali alayhi salam. If they wanted to, they can get a second witness from any of the companions that everyone knew were just, like Salman and Ammar. Everyone knew they were just companions. Any one of them would have been a second witness to this. But she didn't do that. Imam Ali alayhi salam stood with her because Fadak is hers. But she used Fadak in a different way. Instead of taking it to court, she used it as a slogan to show the hypocrisy of the ruling party, to use it as a main weapon against them and try to wake the people up by showing them, look at how he is treating the daughter of your prophet. Look what he's taken from me. So 10 days after Saqifah happened, 10 days after the death of the prophet, Fatima alayhi salam had still not received what's rightfully hers. So she tied a cloth around her head. She gathered the woman of the Banu Hashim and she went to the masjid. And she gathered. Here the Sahaba came, the Muhajireen and the Ansar, and Abu Bakr and Umar stood before her, and she stood and she gave an eloquent khutbah, a very famous speech where she began to accuse the ruling party very directly of what they have done. That there was a conspiracy. She does this publicly in front of everyone. And she does this in a distressed voice. And she makes some of the Ansar and Muhajireen, they begin to cry as they look at her, as she begins to speak. And then she starts to say, the wound had still not healed, and the Prophet was still not buried. And you go and you claim sedition? You claim fitna? You did this to save Islam from fitna? Ala fil fitnati saqatu. They have already tumbled down into fitna. She quotes the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, how you've already fallen into fitna. And how eternal are these words? How powerful are these words that shook them under their feet, shook the ground they were standing on? She's saying, you claimed to be saving Islam, but you created this fitna. You already fell into this fitna. And we have to ask, if you feared fitna so much, then why not ask Rasulullah before he passes? Who should be the Khalifa after you, Ya Rasulullah? When you're asking about how to do the ghusl on him and how to perform the funeral and the prayer and everything else, you don't ask him about the Khilafah? Or do you fear for Islam more than the Prophet fears? That's why you go and you make someone a leader straight away whilst the Prophet is still not buried. Rasulullah warned them. He said, there is a rebellion sparking off. A fitna is coming amongst you like dark pieces of the night. He says something is coming. And subhanAllah, before he passes, he stands in Baqi'ah, he speaks to the graves and he cries and says, how lucky are the people here? How lucky are you all to not be alive right now? Because what is to come is a great sedition, a great fitna is about to ensue. And he was not speaking about the problems that were going to happen 30 years from then with the Battle of Jamal, for example, if someone wants to say that. Or even the apostate battles, which were to happen soon after Saqifah. Because here he's speaking to martyrs, people buried in Baqiyah, mu'mineen, martyrs. He doesn't fear for them to apostatize from Islam. He is speaking about the sedition that was to come at this moment, that Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam was referring to. She looks around and she starts to accuse them. And then she says, for everything there is a wasila, and the wasila to Allah is us. Then she says, Ya Abu Bakr, You can inherit from your father, but I cannot inherit from mine. Didn't Dawood give inheritance to Sulaiman? She looked at the Muhajireen and the Ansar, who looked embarrassed in front of her. She said, how can you watch me? How can you see him taking my right before your very eyes? And none of you come to my aid. She said, I await the day when Allah is the judge and Muhammad is the leader, and the day is Qiyamah. Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam used a very intelligent strategy. She was using proofs from the Islamic text in the Quran, because it was going to show if Abu Bakr was to retreat and give her the land of Fadak, it would show that from the clearest laws of Islam, of inheritance, he didn't even know them. So how could he be fit to be the Khalifa of Islam if he was going to go against them and he didn't know them, if that was the claim? And if he refused what she was speaking right now and her proofs, then he would be refusing the Quran, and someone who refuses the Quran should not be sitting in the place of Rasulullah. This shook Abu Bakr so much that he actually was writing up a document to return Fadak. But Umar stopped him, as I mentioned, and said, how are you going to spend on the Muslims? So he didn't accept for Abu Bakr to give it back to her. Sayyidah Fatima alayhi salam tried her best with all that she could to fight this fight. In the middle of the night, she used to go with Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they would even take Al-Hasan wal-Husayn. They would go to the houses of the chiefs. They would go to the houses of people of Badr. They'd go to the people of the Ansar and Muhajireen at night, and Imam Ali alayhi salam would have to speak to them. He would take Fatima and his sons, reminding them, these are the symbols of your Prophet, the remnants. Remember what happened? Remember you gave bay'ah to me? He was trying his best, so no one could ever say that the Imam did not try everything. He tried everything. This was peaceful resistance now. And they said to Sayyidah Zahra, as she would speak, and she would speak on behalf of Ali, not because Ali couldn't. Imam Ali was the peak of eloquence. Because she was the daughter of the Prophet, she had something no one else had. And people were affected, but they would say, oh, daughter of Rasulullah, we pledged allegiance to Abu Bakr right now. I mean, what are we supposed to do? If Imam Ali was there, we would have pledged allegiance to him. If he was present. And then Imam Ali says, what would you have me do? You wanted me to come and argue about the Khilafah whilst the Prophet is still unburied? I mean, just imagine it. Imagine the Imam leaves the Prophet and goes and says, no, I'm the Imam, what are you doing? He wouldn't do that. You want me to leave the Prophet unburied and for me to go and argue about the Khilafah? So Sayyidah Zahra says, Abu al-Hasan did what he was supposed to do. It is they who will be judged upon what they did. Sayyidah Zahra began to fall ill. Her wounds became great. Her fever became greater. She started to struggle. A group of women went to visit her when she was becoming sick. And as they sat amongst her, she reminded them. She said, I now detest your world and your men. And the women had their heads down because they knew their men had betrayed the rightful Imam. And she said that the people were still jealous of Imam Ali and held a grudge against him for the days gone by, the days of Jahiliyyah. For he had killed many of their relatives when they were enemies of Islam. As the days went by and the issue was settled and Sayyidah Zahra grew more and more sick, Abu Bakr and Umar decided to go and seek forgiveness from Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam. They wanted to apologize. So they went to knock on her house, on her door. They wanted to come in and she refused. She would not let them. Then they asked Imam Ali alayhi salam to intercede. So the Imam asked Sayyidah Zahra alayhi salam, and so Sayyidah Zahra accepted from the Imam. So they came inside. As they came, they said, Salamu alaykum, and she did not respond their salam, and she turned her face from them. As they stood there trying to apologize to her, she turned and she said, did you hear about what Rasulullah used to say about me? They said, yes. And she said, did you hear when he said, what pleases Fatima pleases me? They said, yes. And did you hear when he said, whatever displeases Fatima displeases me? They said, yes. She said, I bear witness to Allah that you both have hurt me and I do not forgive you, and I will complain to my father about you and what you did to me. These words, once again, made the grounds beneath their feet shake. Sayyidah Zahra became more and more sick as time went by. It's reported 3 to 6 months after the death of the Prophet were her last days. When it came to the day when she knew she would leave this world, she struggled to stand up. She wanted to make food on this day. Asma, her helper, came to help her. She said, no, I want to make this food. She made the food, then she bathed Al-Hassan and Hussein and her children. And then she dressed them and she fed them. And she tried her best to act as normal as she could, as if she had no fever and no wound to tend to. Here the hearts of her sons were heavy. They felt something was off, but she was trying her best to smile in their faces. And then she sent them to the masjid. And then she laid. Imam Ali alayhi salam came to her and she said, Ya Ali, you know why I did that. He stood, he held her hand. She said, they've been going through so much. They've suffered so much. I wanted to make them happy. I wanted to see them happy. But we both know what's coming. I'm about to leave this world, Ya Ali. I'm sad because I'm going to be leaving you. I'm happy that I will see my father, but I am sad to depart from you. Your mission carries on. You must promise me that your days will not be days of bitterness. When you remember me, I don't want you to always feel hurt. I want you to stand strong in the times to come. Do you promise me? And the Imam looked at her as tears strolled down his eyes. He said, I promise. And she said, Ya Ali, Hussein is very sensitive. Give him special attention. Be a mother to him as well. And the Imam's tears were scrolling down and dropping onto their hands. She told him, don't cry. Ali, don't cry. You always have such a tough exterior, but I know your heart is so tender. She said, Ya Ali, bury me in the night. Don't let any of them come to my funeral. That is my final will. Farewell, my beloved, my Imam. Farewell, my husband. Farewell, Ya Ali. Please, let me have my moments with Allah. So the Imam kissed her and moved away. And he went to the masjid to pray. Here, she asked Asma to help her lay down towards the Qibla. And she began to recite words of the Qur'an until her last breath. Asma began to cry at the loss of the Lady of the Heavens. Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein returned to the house. When they came in, they saw Asma crying, and Sayyidah Zahra did not greet them at the door. They said, where is our mother? And she told them, Ya Hassan, Ya Hussein, your mother has left this world. And they were shocked. And then they ran to the room to see Sayyidah Zahra laying down lifeless. And they began to hug her. And Imam al-Hassan said, mother, speak to me. I am Hassan. Speak to me before my heart bursts. Imam al-Hussein's grabbing her on the other side. My mother, speak to me. You've left us orphans. Asma told them, go and call your father and tell him what's happened. So they ran outside the house and they ran to the masjid. As they're running, the people are gathering. The Muslims thought that the sons of Rasulullah are coming in this way, the way they are running to the masjid, that something good has happened, but they saw their faces and their tears. They said, what had happened? And they said, our mother has left this world. They called their father, father, mother has left this world. Imam Ali stood and it was like his heart dropped and he choked on his breath. And then he walked with his sons to the house. People came to the house. The Imam told Salman, yes, Salman, tell the people that the funeral is postponed to the night time. Salman told everyone to leave. They left. The Imam came inside. He sat by the body of Sayyidah Zahra. He waited till the night had passed. Then he got up and he began to perform the ghusl on her Asma was helping him to perform the ghusl. But then Asma sees Imam Ali Islam at one point. He goes into the corner, he sits down, and his head is between his knees. And she says, "Ya Ali, you are the hero of Khaybar. You are the hero of Badr. You are the one who lifted the gates. Why are you crying so much?" He's crying like a child. And he says, "As I was doing the ghusl, my hands went over the cracked ribs. The ribs she would never complain about. Never complained to me about her pain." He stood up as much as he could. He tried to gather his strength. He wrapped her in her shroud. In the middle of the night they waited. Until late in the night, only a few trusted companions he had with him, his main followers, the same ones, he brought Hassan and Hussein, and they carried her. And they went out into a secret place, no one knows where. And here, he told Al-Hassan al-Hussein, he narrates, "When I felt like it was the final goodbye, I told Hassan, Hussein, say goodbye to your mother." And they jumped on her, and they hugged her and embraced her. I said, "Mother, send our salams to our grandfather. And now we are orphaned like him, like he was." Then he sends everyone back. The Imam was crying so much, the children were crying so much, that Imam Ali Islam says that one of the angels, he heard a voice of the angels tell him, "Ya Ali, remove Hussein from the chest of Zahra, because we cannot bear to see the way he is crying, the way he is mourning." And we have to ask them, how were you able to see? Shimmer sitting on the chest of Hussein on the day of Karbala. The young Hussein, the young Hassan were taken away. Imam Ali alayhi salam says to everyone, "Now everyone leaves." Now the Imam, he knots the shroud of Zahra. And then he places her blessed body into the grave. And he begins to put the dirt over the grave. And then he sits by the grave until the morning and he cries. Looks into the stars. "My beloved Zahra, you have left this world." And he speaks to Rasulullah, "Ya Rasulullah, I have now lost you and I have lost Fatima. What was given has now been taken back and the amana is returned. Ask her in detail what happened. Let her tell you what occurred with us when you left this world. As for me, my days will now be in agony, grief and pain. But I carry on with the mission that you bestowed upon me." And he stays under the moonlight until he stands to go back home. Tired, heartbroken, he opens the door to his home and sees Al-Hassan al-Hussein still awake, crying. Only a few months prior, he came home from the masjid and saw Hassan al-Hussein and Zahra crying. But now, there was no more Zahra. And Abu Turab is now also Abu al-Aytam. He is the father of the orphans now. And this, of course, leaves him with a heavy heart. Imam Ali had a soft spot for orphans. But now he looked at Hassan al-Hussein, not orphaned from any lady, but often from the Lady of Light, Fatima al-Zahra. And there is a beautiful poem attributed to Imam Ali that he wrote in those days. And some even say on that night, where he speaks to Sayyida Fatima. And I wanted to read it and end this session with this poem. The Imam asks, "Is there a way in which the duration of life could be prolonged? And by which this death will not change things and cause separation? And even though I surely believe in death as a truth, I remain hopeful of our meeting. I see the problems of life surround me a great deal. And even after death, these problems remain. But I surely miss the one I truly love. Is there a path I could take to reach my dear one? For every meeting between two loved ones, there is separation. And everything apart from separation is trivial. And certainly all my yearning for Fatima after Ahmad is proof that no beloved will ever last forever. If at a moment life ends, indeed the cries of the mourners is little. That is why now when I sleep on my side in solitude, and I do not feel loneliness, because the fire within my heart, due to the separation of my beloved, boils. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin.